Latest news around the Mexico border wall and Trump administration policy overall with ICE and border agents. Giancarlo Sfrey, thanks so much for joining us. Two-time Emmy Award-winning journalist and documentary filmmaker. That does it for our show. If you want to see the transcript, video, or audio podcast, or send it around in social media, go to democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Robbie Caron, Hani Massoud, Tarina Nadura, Andre Lewis. I'm Amy Goodman. Our website is democracynow.org. Thanks for joining us.
This is 90.7 FM KBOO Portland. Thanks for tuning in.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Playing Monopoly with God and Other True Stories on August 4th, 7 p.m. at the Old Church in Portland. Playing Monopoly with God and Other True Stories will be performed by Melissa Bangs, who studied with the Upright Citizens Brigade. This is her one-woman comedy show about postpartum psychosis and healing through shared moments, laughter, and tears. Again, that's Playing Monopoly with God and Other True Stories on August 4th, 7 p.m. at the Old Church, 1422 Southwest 11th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO is getting ready for our annual book and record sale. Your unwanted books, records, and DVDs are treasures to someone else. Help them find new homes while raising money for your community radio station, KBOO. Bring them to KBOO, 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. We are accepting donations of books, vinyl records, CDs, and DVDs through Friday, August 11th. Please, no home-recorded cassettes, VHS tapes, or mold. The KBOO book and record sale will be held on Saturday, August 19th. If you have questions or want to arrange for a pickup of donations, please email Ani at volunteer@kboo.org. or phone her at 503-231-8032, extension 213.
Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Androids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com. This program is made possible by them.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, President Trump today appeared at the White House with two Southern Republican senators to unveil a new Senate bill that could cut the amount of green cards issued by 50%.
TriMet is not checking fares today due to the heat, which may increase existing delays.
Italy's parliament approved a plan to send naval boats to Libya to stop the influx of migrants crossing the Mediterranean Sea.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, August 2nd, 2017. I'm Kyle Carezzi.
And I'm Erin J. Bernard. You've probably noticed that it's hot out. If you are looking for some fun new ways to beat the heat, several community centers in Portland are offering some cool opportunities. The Charles Jordan Community Center, Mount Scott Community Center, and the East Portland Community Center will all have family-friendly activities available on Thursday and Friday for selected hours. The Hillside Community Center, Southwest Community Center, and Matt Dishman Community Center will be showing a selection of movies for selected days and hours. And the Community Music Center on Southeast Francis Street is making their auditorium available on Thursday. Classes will be held from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m., but the public is welcome as a quiet audience. For more information, visit portlandoregon.gov/parks.
Now here's a report from our pals from Oregon News Service.
Clean energy advocates in the Northwest say the Bonneville Power Administration's decision to reduce the rate charged on wind energy transmitted from Montana will do little to encourage renewable energy use in the region. Bonneville Power announced it would reduce what is known as the intertie rate, a charge on the use of transmission lines in western Montana, by 15% through 2019. Jeff Fox, Montana policy manager with Renewable Northwest, says the rate reduction is unlikely to encourage use of the system.
I would call the reduction an insufficient consolation prize. It really sort of acknowledges the problem and corrects some errors with the fee, but doesn't go far enough in that the rate really needs to be eliminated.
Fox compares it to a toll road that no one is using. The barrier for renewables is too high to access the transmission lines, and so Bonneville Power doesn't actually see the benefit for charging this rate. Less than 10% of the capacity where this rate applies is currently in use, according to the Northwest Energy Coalition. Fox says elimination of the intertie rate has almost unprecedented support from Oregon, Washington, and Montana politicians. He says the rate's elimination would open up the wind market for Montana and provide it to metropolitan areas of the Northwest that need it most. It would also provide power when the region needs it the most. Northwest utility use peaks in the winter.
It produces most of its energy during the winter. It also produces most of its energy during the day, and that's really important for the Northwest, which tends to produce the greatest amount of energy when the hydro dams are at their fullest in the spring months. So this is a resource that fits in well to the Northwest.
Bonneville Power acknowledged in its decision to reduce the intertie rate that there were inconsistencies in how the rate was calculated. The importance of wind energy is likely to increase as Colstrip, a coal-fired power plant providing power to the Northwest, is retired over the next few years. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Recently, Oregon Live began reporting on the difficulties concerning a transgendered youth named Jay. In 2015, Jay was 15. By then, he had been living his life as any other straight boy would. He spiked his hair, fretted over girls, listened to Tupac, and wondered what he would wear at the next high school dance. But Jay also had to worry about things most boys don't, hiding his breasts. Like most transitioning folks, Jay's struggle to transition was long, arduous, and fraught with confusing medical information. But at his young age, this was even more difficult, considering that Jay also had to worry about being 15. Dealing with bullies, navigating the dreaded paths of puberty, and dodging the constant media attention that the word transgender was now being given. Several of Jay's doctors worried that he might not be making the right decision for himself and worried that he might later regret the many procedures he would have to undergo. Jay was 15 when Caitlyn Jenner came out publicly on national news as a transgender woman. While this news was met with a measure of misunderstanding from those unfamiliar with transitioning, by and large, she still received widespread support from major media institutions. While we celebrate her victory, it is important to remember that not many folks in the transgender community have such access to Hollywood and other media vectors for support. Indeed, many struggle silently every day with a reality that has been called a mental illness. While there has been a public outcry of support from both the media and the community, what of those who still slip through the cracks, living their lives without any public support to speak of? What of young people who aren't yet allowed to legally represent themselves and don't yet have the capability of navigating the complicated world of healthcare? The catch-all term transgender was removed from the DSM-5 in 2013, effectively declassifying it as a mental disorder. However, many transgender folks may inadvertently fall under the classification gender dysphoria if diagnosed by a psychologist, which many transitioning folks are required to see before surgeries will be considered. Additionally, most healthcare insurance providers still require transgendered folks to be diagnosed with a DSM-5 specified disability before qualifying for a medical procedure.
TriMet said they won't be checking fares today because of the heat, but more riders will only increase existing delays. The agency has struggled with network outages since Saturday when a scheduled maintenance project went awry. Efforts to fix the network problem brought the MAX light rail system to a halt mid-morning Tuesday, which also affected ticket vending machines and electronic fare payment. When temperatures reach 90 degrees, MAX will slow by 10 miles per hour in high-speed zones, while trains often reach 55 miles per hour to avoid drooping overhead wires and potential derailments due to tracks deformed by the heat. If temperatures reach 100, MAX trains will not exceed 35 miles per hour. At noon today, TriMet turned off the elevators at the Southeast Bybee and Rhone MAX platforms because of heat issues.
If you've been in Portland today and looked up, you might have noticed a bit of a haze building up. Well, the Gazette Times in Corvallis is reporting that this might be due to a series of wildfires in British Columbia and another near Mount Jefferson. Folks with respiratory issues are cautioned to stay indoors. Although there's an unlikely silver lining to these clouds of smoke, it might help keep temperatures down, says meteorologist Matthew Cullen. He says that the smoke will be here until at least Friday, but if the fires worsen, their departure date might be a little hazy.
And now here are the latest in the discussion on water sustainability with Current Cast.
Fish farming or not in the Great Lakes on today's Current Cast. Offshore aquaculture, or fish farming, is not allowed in U.S. water in the Great Lakes. So when two companies requested permission to begin raising fish in pens in Lake Michigan, there were concerns.
There's significant risk and unknown environmental impacts that could result.
That's Jennifer McKay with the Tip of the Mitt Watershed Council. She says fish that escape the pens can become invasive. Fish farms can also lead to the spread of disease that could harm native species and put the Great Lakes sustainable wild fisheries at risk. So the state of Michigan recently decided aquaculture is off the table, at least for now. Current Cast is produced in partnership with Cornell University's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more at currentcast.org.
A lot of folks want high-quality drinking water. A potential solution for this is a water filter that attaches directly onto the faucet. But Nancy Love, college professor and author of a new study in environmental science, water research, and technology, has a warning. While these filters are instrumental in filtering out heavy metals and disinfectants, in many cases the filters will actually promote bacteria growth, sometimes up to 100 times, Love warns. She does note that not all bacteria is necessarily harmful, but certain strains could potentially cause health issues, especially for people with compromised immune systems. Love recommends proper and regular cleaning of these filters in accordance with manufacturer direction. She also recommends every morning turning the filter on to bypass, flushing it for 15 to 30 seconds before switching the filter back on, and then running the water for an additional 15 seconds before regular consumption.
And now we'll take a listen to the latest in environmental issues from the Green News Report.
The company says killing the project will save you the $7 billion it would have cost to finish it.
South Carolina nuclear plants canceled.
Authorities ordered visitors to leave, which means vacations have been cut short.
North Carolina's Outer Banks are out of power. Humanity is on track to blow past 2 degrees Celsius of global warming. Some coastal towns will see effective inundation within 20 years. Plus, blowback as Trump threatens to protect Alaska's environment.
Vote for my health care bill or the environment doesn't get it. All of those stories and more straight ahead from bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
I had former Vice President Al Gore on the show to promote his sequel to An Inconvenient Truth. After all, there's no better way to show you care about the planet than sitting in a theater with the air conditioner blasting while drinking out of giant plastic cups.
Yep. This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, during the recent healthcare insanity in the U.S. Senate, Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke threatened Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski that the Trump administration would retaliate against Alaska if she voted against the Republicans' repeal scheme. And they were going to retaliate by protecting the environment?
Yeah, they were going to retaliate by blocking her pro-oil agenda for Alaska. However, as chair of the Senate Energy Committee, Murkowski controls Zinke's budget and confirmations. But Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, he can block Murkowski's massive new energy bill that is now on hold in the Senate, in which she seeks to expand oil drilling in Alaska.
A lot of politics, a lot of people trying really hard to not do the right thing.
Two new studies warn that we are on track to blow way past the target limit of 2 degrees Celsius that nations agreed on in the Paris Climate Accord.
Oh, great.
The two separate studies, using entirely different methods, project that, based on current emissions policies, there's a 95% chance that the planet will warm more than 2 degrees Celsius by the end of the century, and could potentially warm as much as a catastrophic 4 degrees Celsius. The new projections are part of an emerging scientific understanding that governments are not ramping down emissions fast enough to avoid really dangerous climate impacts.
So it's almost certain that we're going to exceed this 2 degrees Celsius target by the end of the century, correct?
Yes, unless we reduce emissions faster than we are doing.
And that seems very unlikely at this point.
Another blow to the troubled U.S. nuclear energy industry. In South Carolina, utility companies Santee Cooper and Scana Corporation announced on Monday they will halt construction of two new nuclear reactors at the already existing VC Summer Nuclear Power Plant. That occurred after problems with the design of the reactor caused persistent delays and massive cost overruns. No decision yet on what that means for customers who've been paying in advance for years for those two unfinished nuclear reactors.
But the good news, they're saving taxpayers $7 billion for what you have described many times as the world's most expensive way ever invented to boil water.
In North Carolina, tens of thousands of tourists have been ordered to evacuate North Carolina's Outer Banks at the height of the summer season, but not because of a hurricane, for once. Officials say construction crews building a bridge accidentally damaged all three underground power lines from the mainland, cutting off all electricity to the remote barrier islands. Only those with off-grid energy resources can remain.
Oh, like people with solar?
Yep. Last week, we reported that the Coast Guard is planning for an overall rise in sea levels of about 6 feet by 2100. But a new study from the Union of Concerned Scientists warns many U.S. coastal communities will be hit with effective inundation in just 20 years. Effective inundation is disruptive chronic flooding on a near weekly basis or more due to rising seas caused by global warming. The report identifies more than 170 U.S. towns and communities that could be effectively inundated as early as 2035.
Wow.
But home buyers in Miami are apparently oblivious to these warnings. According to a new survey by the Miami Herald, two-thirds of home buyers in South Florida never ask their real estate brokers about the potential impacts of rising seas on their property or their future property values.
That's some smart buyers.
Finally, some good news. A top executive at pipeline company TransCanada says they may scrap the idea of building the controversial Keystone XL pipeline across Nebraska after all. That's due to a lack of customers wanting to ship dirty tar sands oil from Alberta. That negative outlook is not likely to improve soon. The Calgary Herald reports that oil companies in Alberta's tar sands have voluntarily given back more than 2.5 million acres of oil exploration leases because of a drop in demand and the crash in global oil prices.
So sad to hear it. For much more on all of those stories and the many we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find us, follow us, and share us worldwide, please, on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
And now we hear the latest from Workers Independent News.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a Diversified Media Enterprises production. I'm Doug Cunningham. Illinois Federation of Teachers President Dan Montgomery says in vetoing the school funding bill, SB1, Governor Bruce Rauner is pitting downstate Illinois against Chicago for his own political gain. Rauner's amendatory veto Tuesday takes a $250 million block grant from Chicago Public Schools and changes how Chicago Public Schools' pensions are funded. The IFT says Rauner vetoed a balanced bipartisan budget bill that ended a two-year budget crisis in Illinois of the governor's own making. That veto was overridden. The teachers' union says SB1 attempted to address school funding inequities. The IFT says the bill would, quote, treat all school districts in the state the same going forward and regularizes how teacher retirements are funded everywhere. The National Labor Relations Board is bringing a new complaint against Nissan alleging unfair labor practices in advance of this week's vote by workers to organize with the UAW. Workers at the Canton, Mississippi plant say Nissan is waging a very aggressive anti-union campaign. The NLRB complaint says Nissan is violating labor law by threatening to close the plant. It's also breaking the law, according to the NLRB, by interrogating workers about their union support and, in effect, trying to bribe them for voting against the union by promising added benefits and improved working conditions if workers vote against the UAW this week. The voting happens this Thursday and Friday. UAW Secretary Treasurer Gary Castile says after seeing Nissan's threats and intimidation tactics escalate, it's now clear that Nissan has no intention of letting employees vote in a free and fair election. Professor Lance Compa of Cornell University's School of Industrial and Labor Relations says Nissan's illegal anti-union activity is sustained and documented from worker interviews.
Nissan has used an array of tactics designed to basically instill fear among employees about the choice of organizing or union representation.
Compa says it includes intimidation from day one when employees are hired, and Nissan lies about it being non-union because it is unionized worldwide except for the United States.
It starts with day one of the employee's hire. The employees that I interviewed all recounted to me that when they were first hired at the company, part of the new employee orientation included a very hard-hitting attack on unions. Unions are job killers. Unions are plant closers.
Canton, Mississippi Nissan workers and the UAW are waging a strong pro-union campaign to try and overcome the fear with the help of the civil rights movement and other union organizers from around the country. But Mississippi workers are voting this week with the employer's figurative gun at their heads, threatening their livelihoods if they vote for the UAW. Workers Independent News is made possible in part through support from the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, North America's strongest union, online at teamsters.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit workersindependentnews.com.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for news from the BOO. At 6, it's Kitchen Table Conversations, followed at 7 by Keeping It Real. Tonight's weather will be a low of 69. Tomorrow could reach 105 degrees with smoky skies. Today in history, in 1950, the first U.S. Marines arrived in Korea. The quote of the day is from writer James Baldwin, whose birthday is today. It is certain, in any case, that ignorance, allied with power, is the most ferocious enemy justice can have.
I'm Rick Smith, and
now we'll take a look at this day in labor history.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1934. That was the day striking Teamsters in Minneapolis defied martial law. They stopped scab trucks, forcing the release of their strike leaders. Armed with bayonets and machine guns, the National Guard had patrolled the streets for nearly a week. They seized scores of strikers and union leaders and threw them into military stockades. Drivers were outraged. They defied Governor Olson and Major General Walsh, who, on behalf of the Citizens Alliance and trucking bosses, were determined to break the strike. Soon after strikers were imprisoned, drivers began chasing scab trucks across the city. Multiple reports poured in of picketers forcing trucks to stop. Some unloaded their cargo onto bridges. Others chased, captured, and damaged the scab trucks. Strikers ripped ignition wires out, forced scabs from the wheel, and then disappeared before police and the National Guard could arrive to retaliate. In just 3 hours, strikers had overturned nearly 70 trucks. Unable to stop the superior force of striking drivers, Bill Brown, Vincent, and Miles Dunn were ordered unconditionally released from the military stockades. Now, employers, the governor, and other strike-breaking agencies were eager to propose peace to federal mediators. but they proposed to scrap the terms of their earlier May agreement. In response, the leaders of Local 574 issued a general strike call. In it, they asked, quote, "Is there one man so blind as not to see that if 574 is allowed to go down to defeat under the brutal hammering of military despotism, the whole labor movement of the city will have been dealt a mortal blow? Union men, brothers, sisters, fellow workers, what are you going to do about it? We appeal to you for solidarity."
Labor History in 2, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
And now listen to some reports from National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Tara Gatewood, in for Antonia Gonzalez. There have been more calls for a reset of Canada's national inquiry into murdered and missing Indigenous women and girls. They come in the wake of several delays and high-level resignations from the commission. But as Dan Karpinchuk reports, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau will give in to those demands.
The two-year process has been sharply criticized, especially after one of the five commissioners resigned last week, and some families of the victims are calling for a complete reboot of the process. Some have suggested that the commission was in serious trouble and needed to shift its approach. The more than $50 million inquiry is to examine the root causes of violence against Indigenous women and girls. The Native Women's Association of Canada says it was supportive of the inquiry at first, but less so now. And in Manitoba, there have been growing calls for the other four commissioners to step down. However, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau is resisting any major changes.
The inquiry needs to provide justice for the victims, healing for the families, and put an end to this ongoing tragedy. It was always and will always be and would always be a very difficult process.
Trudeau did say, however, that his government would engage with the commission to make sure it's responding to the concerns raised by families. Those families have raised issues about the lack of information of how the inquiry's hearings will work and fears that vulnerable survivors and their families will be re-traumatized. They also ask why only one hearing has been held in almost a year. Supporters say the process has not been perfect, and the commissioners had to start a national inquiry from nothing, and they're learning as they go. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
Negotiations are ongoing between the state of Wisconsin and two Lake Superior tribes over how they will jointly manage fish harvests in Lake Superior. Daniel Kading has more.
Fisheries biologist Brad Ray with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources says the state, Red Cliff, and Bad River bands of Lake Superior Chippewa are harvesting under an extension of an existing agreement.
We're still in ongoing negotiations to try to get that done for this year, but we're effectively operating on the 2005-2015 agreement.
The agency declined to comment further on the negotiations. Some state commercial and sports anglers have expressed frustration over their share of fish as the DNR has limited lake trout harvests. Former Red Cliff tribal chairman Brian Bainbridge says lake trout are split evenly.
50% goes to the state, mostly goes to their sport anglers. You know, they have commercial fishermen, but it's split different than we do, and the other 50% is split between Bad River and Red Cliff.
Bainbridge is optimistic a deal can be reached by November of this year. He says negotiations are taking a long time because everyone involved wants to get it right.
We all have to answer to our constituents as we're going through this, and but also making sure we're doing the and making the best decisions based off whatever science we have gathered and to really protect the resource.
Bainbridge says negotiations have included discussions about restrictions on harvesting in certain areas of the lake for sport, commercial, and tribal fishers. For National Native News, I'm Danielle Kading.
Searching for a better view on urban Indian disability needs, a national organization launches a major project. The National Council of Urban Indian Health is asking the public to participate in an online survey to help assess the needs of Native Americans and Alaska Natives living with disabilities in urban areas in the states of California, Oregon, and Washington. One of the aims of the Native Communities Living United for Disability Equality Project is to help improve services. For more information on this project, interested participants can visit the Council's website. I'm Tara Gatewood.
President Trump today appeared at the White House with two Southern Republican senators to unveil a new Senate bill that could cut the amount of green cards issued by 50%. The RAISE Act, Reforming American Immigration for Strong Employment, creates a merit-based immigration system awarding points on such factors as English fluency, education, and job skills. This legislation marks a major shift in U.S. immigration laws, which over the past half century have permitted a growing number of immigrants to come to the country legally. Drastic cuts will be made to family-based immigration programs that allow siblings and grown children of U.S. citizens and legal residents to apply for green cards. The group Asian Americans Advancing Justice said in a statement, "The RAISE Act is part of a larger strategy to scapegoat immigrants and further marginalize people of color."
While the country waits to hear what Jeff Sessions' Justice Department will do about legalized marijuana, the department's working on another target, affirmative action at universities. The Trump administration is preparing to redirect resources of the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division toward investigating and suing universities over affirmative action admissions policies deemed to discriminate against white applicants. The investigation is not being led by seasoned Justice Department employees, but by Trump's political appointees. According to Kristen Clark, executive director of Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights Under Law, throughout his career, Attorney General Jeff Sessions has pushed efforts to end affirmative action programs, and he has a clear record of hostility to racial diversity. The Supreme Court has ruled that the educational benefits of having a diverse student body can justify using race as one factor among many in evaluating applicants, while rejecting blunt racial quotas or race-based point systems.
And now we have an uplifting report on people's adaptations to climate change with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Mosquitoes are nothing new to Minnesotans, who sometimes refer to the infamous pest as their state bird.
Mosquitoes are considered both a nuisance and a vector for certain types of diseases.
Mark Seeley is a climatologist and professor at the University of Minnesota. He says mosquitoes thrive in warm, wet conditions. A warm early spring means mosquitoes have a chance to breed sooner, leading to more mosquitoes and potentially more disease. As the world warms, spring is arriving earlier and earlier.
Something like 75% of the last 20 spring seasons we've had have come on extraordinarily early.
Intense rainfalls have also become more frequent. When the ground cannot absorb more water, standing pools provide mosquitoes with an ideal habitat and breeding ground. It all adds up to a long, buggy summer. On average, the mosquito season in Minneapolis is more than 30 days longer today than it was in 1980. As the climate in Minneapolis continues to warm, so will the potential for outbreaks of mosquito-borne diseases, such as West Nile virus. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
You might not know that today is Earth Overshoot Day, but it's not something to celebrate. As of August 2nd, the world's population has used as much natural resources as a planet will produce the entire year. We emitted more carbon than the oceans and forests can absorb in a year. We caught more fish, cut more trees, and consumed more water than the Earth was able to produce in all of 2016. In 2007, this overshoot wasn't reached until December 7th. That's four more months of environmental debt in just 11 years.
And now here's the latest on the fight against overbearing drug legislation with 420 Drug War News.
It's the 420 Drug War News. Here's part of my recent discussion with Major Neil Franklin, Director of Law Enforcement Action Partnership. I asked him if this drug war did not make us all suspects.
Baltimore just recently underwent a Department of Justice investigation on the heels of the death of Freddie Gray, the young man who died while being transported in a police van. They looked at about 4.5 years of policing history in Baltimore right before Freddie Gray's death. They discovered, after going through the police records, that over 300,000 mainly black men and women had been stopped on the streets in Baltimore. And of that 300,000 plus, only 3.7% of those stops resulted in a citation being issued or someone being arrested. That means that there was probable cause, in a sense, maybe not in all those cases, What about the other 96.3% of those stops? What were they about? I tell you what they were about. They were about police looking for drugs, believing that everyone on that street is a suspect. They were about unconstitutional searches in the middle of the street, some of them being strip searches of not just men but also women, where cavity searches were done. But then they questioned those numbers, and they went back and they decided to look at the radio transmissions and do a sampling of the radio transmissions. And they realized that a very, very large portion of the actual stops were not being documented. So doing the sampling of the radio transmissions, they were able to arrive at a conclusion that the actual numbers of stops of citizens on the streets were actually seven times greater.
Wow. Wow.
So that 300,000 plus now goes to 2.1 million stops. The tickets and the citation, that number stays the same. However, that means that the percentage of tickets being written or arrests being made now drops dramatically. It now goes from 3.7% of 300,000 stops to 0.5% of 2.1 million stops. My God, 99.5% of 2.1 million stops within that time period are absolutely questionable, according to violations of our Constitution of these United States. Dean, there's a crystal clear example of everybody being suspected of being involved in the drug trade, of being a drug dealer, of just being a bad person walking the streets within our nation.
To learn more, please visit leap.cc, DeanBeckerDrugTruth.net.
Italy's parliament approved a plan to send naval boats to Libya to stop the influx of migrants crossing the Mediterranean Sea. They claim that the chief objective is to help the Libyan Coast Guard target people smugglers. Italy, along with Greece, is the main receptor for migrants from northern parts of Africa and the Middle East. Over 110,000 migrants have crossed the Mediterranean to seek asylum in the European Union, who recently passed a law pressuring migrants to seek asylum in the first country they land, either usually Italy or Greece. The amount of migrants from Libya have increased since the death of Gaddafi in 2013, as the ensuing power struggle within the country causes duress on its citizens.
If you are planning on taking a vacation trip to North Korea, you better hurry up. The U.S. State Department is banning all travel to the country for 1 year, starting on September 1st. This is a response to increased tensions as well as the threat of long-term detention. Once in effect, North Korea will be the only country to which Americans are banned from traveling. Certain journalists and humanitarian workers may still apply. However, the State Department warns that all folks utilizing a U.S. passport in North Korea should depart before the start of the travel ban. Currently, two Korean Americans are detained in North Korea, along with a Canadian pastor and three South Korean nationals. Japan has also reported several internments of its citizens.
How has the potentially explosive relationship between America and Russia changed? Here are a few things to know about the Russia sanctions. The bill imposes heavy financial penalties on Russia, North Korea, and Iran for acts the U.S. has identified as contradictory to both national interests of America and the interests of allies. The sanctions are intended to punish Russia and have been mainly set up to accommodate Russia's alleged campaign of fake news and cyber hacks which influenced the 2016 election, allegedly. It is not out of line to say that the lawmakers are pleased. In spite of Trump's evident displeasure in the sanctions imposed on Russia, the bill passed with flying colors in the Senate with a 98-2. Similarly, the House passed the bill with a striking 419-3. The bill was so popular that the House could have effortlessly overridden Trump's veto. The sanctions are intended to target Russian President Vladimir Putin in addition to those within his inner circle. The U.S. insists the target group within Vladimir's inner circle is loaded with corrupted officials and human rights abusers. The sanctions specifically target the country's oil and mining industries and aim to penalize those who were involved with Russian government hacking activities. Putin recently announced that the U.S. will have to reduce its embassy and consulate staff. 755 U.S. employees will be removed from duty as of September 1st this year. After this mass cut of staff, 455 U.S. embassy and consulate staff will remain in Russia.
The European Union is disavowing Venezuela's new assembly that has been tasked with rewriting the country's constitution. This comes at a particularly inconvenient time for the country following accusations of voter fraud during Sunday's elections, which ran in favor of President Nicolas Maduro. Nicolas Maduro has been the president of Venezuela since 2013, succeeding Hugo Chavez, but the controversy surrounding the recent election has led President Donald Trump to hail Maduro a dictator and impose heavy sanctions against Venezuela. Vice President Mike Pence was quoted saying, "The United States calls all who cherish freedom to condemn the Maduro regime for its abuse of power and its abuse of its own people." The U.S. State Department has issued a travel warning to all U.S. citizens cautioning against travel to Venezuela.
U.S. and South Korean scientists have eliminated a genetic attribute that provokes heart disease from a human embryo. This is the first time a genetic disease has been edited out of DNA. The experiment is part of a utilization of CRISPR, the backbone of genome editing technology since 2015. The genetic repair happened during conception. This and other CRISPR experiments raises ethical questions on tampering with a human's genetic code, while scientists claim CRISPR can pave the way for eliminating thousands of genetic diseases.
The hottest temperature in Portland today might be KBOO News poet Dan Raphael.
I know Trump's not causing this heat as further distraction, as if the mooch Trump Jr. and frequent tweet storms aren't distraction enough. I know Trump's homes and the homes of the 1%, unlike 271,000 Portland residences, all have air conditioning. Sure, they'll lose beachfront property to rising oceans, but they're already buying more, higher up, with plenty of water. There's no profit in keeping oil, coal, and gas in the ground, and Trump continues to play footsie with the Saudis and other oil producers while threatening those who won't play back, like Venezuela and Iran. They got to get tar sands, oil, and frack gas to the West Coast to pay off our growing debt to China, build that Kalama methanol plant to guzzle 500,000 gallons of Columbia River a day. As banks own more and more property, skyrocketing rents, selling small houses and micro condos is a green trend and not a way of warehousing cheap labor. In a couple weeks or months, the weather will cool, the rains will come back, but I know even in January, when I wake up and hear the day's news, the sweat of fear and despair will come pouring off me, and how will a heat pump or insulation help that? For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Dan Raphael, Zion Bro, Fox Wild, and Kilton Dolma. The producer is myself, Kyle Kurezi. Our engineer is Nadia Klemenko with David Kesters. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Zelos Marchant. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Kyle Kurezi.
And I'm Erin J. Bernard. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on Voices from the Edge, poet and activist John Slaughter welcomes Portland artists Mighty, Mike Capes, and more. At 9, it's Press Watch. Teresa Mitchell brings you the news you're not supposed to know. At 10, Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on Between the Covers, Between the Covers talks to author Julie Israel about her new book, Juniper Lemon's Happiness Index, a story of grief, friendship, and secrets. And at 11:30, Black Book Talk rebroadcasts its interview with Portland poet, actor, vocalist, and author Mario DePriest about his book, The Power of a Rose, what he calls an attempt to interject a calming breeze of romantic hope into a world of turbulence. KABU keeps you informed and involved, and we need your help. Go to KBOO.FM and click on Donate to become a member.
And now it's time for News from the Boo, the weekly segment from people inside of and around KABU with news from your community radio station.
Hello and welcome to News from the Boo, your weekly update about what's going on in and around KABU. I'm Delphine Crescenzo, and today I'm super excited because the co-host of the show, Gil Cardon, is with me, and the new co-host of the show, Mike Crenshaw, is also here joining us. How are you guys doing today?
I'm good, Del. This is Mike, and it's good to be back.
Totally awesome. Thanks, Del, and glad to have Mike back with us. So, Mike, you're back here joining us as interim station co-manager, but wanted to catch up with you. I mean, some listeners out there may not know your history with KABU, so I just wanted to ask, since you've been involved with KABU community for a while now, could you please tell our listeners what initially brought you here?
Monica, the former station co-manager, and myself have been involved in various levels of community organizing for years. And when the opportunity arose for us to work as a team, we decided to apply for a job together. And it was at the time that KABU's position for management, station manager, was open. And so we got our story together and approached KABU as a team. Mm-hmm. And applied, and we got the job. And so we co-managed KABU together for a couple of years. I resigned after 2 years and went on to focus on some other things in life, and Monica stayed. And then when she resigned, you and Del started. So
we definitely were inspired by